Authentic Wellness Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome to episode number 45 of Authentic Wellness Radio. Today we're talking gluten-free hacks for healthy digestion, and we're also going to be talking about something that we don't really get to mention a lot on this show, which is saving money, which we're going to cover a lot today, and we'll do that with food. So my guest today is the author of The Savvy Gluten-Free Shopper, How to Eat Healthy Without Breaking the Bank. She's the owner of Gluten-Free School, which you can find at glutenfreeschool.com, I believe is the website. She's been featured on Dr. Oz, CNN, Huffington Post, and she appeared on Paleo Hacks, which is one of my favorite podcasts to listen to. Her name is Jennifer Fugo, and she's joining me right now. Jennifer, how are you going?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me. Now, this is such a hugely important topic, gluten, and it causes all kinds of problems for people that I meet. Like, I don't think there's anyone who I've ever worked with who didn't feel significantly better or have a massive change to their health when they stop eating gluten, and it can hit people in really surprising ways. But you actually have an interesting story, which isn't actually that uncommon. I see these kind of symptoms happening with people all the time, but what exactly happened to you?
Yeah, so I'm from an Italian family, and so right there, at least in the States, you know, an Italian family, like, you eat a lot of bread, a lot of pasta, very like wheat-based, pastry, you know, all that stuff. And I thought that all these digestive issues that I had, like gas, diarrhea, bloating, I thought that a lot of it was normal. So I wrote that off for most of my life. I can't even tell you how far back that went, because I just thought stomach issues in my family are normal, whatever, that's how you are. And when I was around 27 years old, I started to have some significant health issues where I really felt terrible. And I had started doing long distance road cycling and was consuming a lot of like oatmeal and porridges and cereals and all sorts of stuff as part of my fueling regimen.
You know what? You're talking to me. I used to be a cyclist, and that was the best pre-training meal you could possibly eat was oats.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was getting terribly sick on my bike, like so sick that I would look around going, oh my gosh, where is the bathroom? Like, I need to go now. And, you know, it's just terrible. And I didn't feel well. I had gotten headaches since I was a teenager. I didn't know those were connected until later. I was getting sick every 4 to 6 weeks. With any cold or flu that was floating around. And I had actually gained, so I'm doing like long distances. I know maybe like some people listening are familiar with like kilometers, but at least in the States we look at miles, and like we were doing like 35 miles of riding in one day. It's really a lot. And I was gaining weight, not losing it, gaining. And by the point when I finally sat down and talked with someone, I had gained close to nearly 20 pounds. And there was no amount of dieting or exercise that was reversing that trend. And the other thing too, when I mentioned, I always had these stomach problems, I had really severe issues. Like if I went out to eat and I would immediately get sick to my stomach within 10 to 15 minutes of eating something. I loved Italian restaurants. And it was to the point where I'd go to the bathroom once and then come back trying to like, you know, get through the whole process as fast as possible and look like nothing happened. And then within 10 minutes of sitting down, I immediately would be like, you know, folded over and clenching my gut and trying to like look like nothing's wrong and then hope that I can make it through for another 20 minutes and then kindly excuse myself from the table and go back to the bathroom looking like I wasn't running because I was so sick to my stomach. And I think that people don't realize that that kind of experience is not normal. And I also came to learn that the skin rashes that I had were an issue. As I said, the headaches, there was just so many different problems, and I'm glad that I was able to resolve them. I took gluten out and felt a massive change within 3 days. And I'm not going to say like I was healed or cured or anything like that, but it was huge. My stomach finally was quiet. My digestive system calmed down. And then in keeping it out for the next few months, I noticed massive changes, and I lost that that excess weight. I started to have a lot more energy because fatigue was a serious issue. The headaches stopped. It was just life-changing. And you can see in my before and after picture, like, I know that people can doctor. You've probably seen that online. A lot of people in the wellness industry complain about doctored before and after pictures. But my pictures are just of my face, and you can see the incredible amount of inflammation that was in my face before versus after. It's not mistakable. It's something you can't fake. And it was really astounding, to the point where people who hadn't seen me in about a year while I was going through this process and then saw me after when I'd lost all the weight were like, what happened to you? Like, it was just so, they're like, you look so different. That's the thing that people don't fully understand, is that this process, when you're consuming food, any food, that is not working ideally with your body, can really have an effect on it physically, mentally, emotionally. And people notice this. And that's why a lot of times when you take gluten out or something that bothers you and you go through that change and you really sort of, I don't want to say detoxify because it's not really correct, but you allow yourself that time to get rid of the inflammation and whatnot, people will notice that you look different, you feel different, your energy's different. And there's a reason why.
I want to talk about that energy word that you just mentioned. Now, one of the things that you suffered with was that you were totally unable to wake up and get out of bed in the morning, even sometimes when you'd had 9 hours worth of sleep. What was that like?
Oh, that was one of the worst periods of my life. I said I was 20, I was 27 years old. Like, I remembered, you know, not all that far, you know, 5 years out of college. I used to stay up all night for schoolwork. Like, I shouldn't feel like an, you know, like, I don't mean to say this in a mean way, but an old person, you know, like, I had no energy. And I guess it was compounded by the fact that I was doing all this exercising. That probably did not help at all. However, when I would wake up, I felt like I was drugged. I could not kind of come out of my slumber. And my husband would have to like really shake me and just pull me out of bed. And he's like, Jen, you have to get up. You're going to be late for work. And I thought to myself, something is really wrong. I was to the doctors. They did blood work and urinary analyses, and nothing came back abnormal. And I was told just to take some B vitamins, that maybe that would help me. You know, to be honest with you, that was back in 2007, so we're looking at almost 9 years now. There's been a massive shift that at least doctors, at least in the States, are starting to have a little bit more awareness that food can dramatically impact your health. But the fact that my fatigue was so great, and by the way, for any of those of you who are familiar with the term adrenal fatigue, which is technically HPA axis dysregulation, but adrenal fatigue is the more colloquial term. I didn't have that. I was actually tested initially before any food sensitivity testing for adrenal fatigue, and I didn't have adrenal fatigue. I was just so exhausted from consuming foods that were sapping my energy and creating a massive amount of inflammation in my system.
Mm, absolutely. Now, when it comes to all these symptoms that you had, I mean, you're quite a severe case, but do you think that gluten was the cause of all of those? And do you think it can be an equally big problem for everyone who's listening to this, if they're resonating and saying, yeah, you know, I suffer from that as well? Can gluten be the cause of just about all these things?
It can be. There are plenty of things that I don't experience that other people do. And, you know, they're thinking now that, you know, gluten sensitivity, and I don't know if you've preface this with your audience and other podcasts, but there is gluten sensitivity and then there's celiac disease, which are two totally separate things. And the incidence of celiac disease is increasing. Now, whether it's increasing because more people are getting celiac disease or we're just better at diagnosing it, which is also a real probability, is an interesting thing to note. Some people will say that the rate of gluten sensitivity is like 50%. I believe Dr. Rodney Ford, and I'm pretty sure, I think he's in New Zealand. He's considered an expert on gluten, and he's been cited in many, many books and all sorts of things. I believe he says that that it's about 50% of people that at least he's aware of that probably suffer with gluten sensitivity, whereas you have other people that say it's probably not that high. I personally think that if you have an issue, any type of issue, and you're online perusing the internet or you're listening to a podcast or anything, and you're like, wow, that person's story really sounds like my own, there is nothing wrong with giving like gluten-free a try for like 2 weeks. If you feel better, then I would say at that point, I would advise you to go to the doctors and get checked for celiac disease. And the only reason I say that is because celiac disease is an autoimmune disease, and you want to know if you have an autoimmune condition, because autoimmunity in and of itself, it's not like I just have celiac disease. You are in an autoimmune state. You want to know that, because you can then, you then have an increased risk of developing more autoimmune diseases on top of the one you already have. And there's also an interesting statistic. I don't know if this applies to Australia, but it is in the United States, that, you know, Hashimoto's thyroiditis is a big problem. Low thyroid issues are a huge problem. 1 in 8 women in the United States is diagnosed with low thyroid issues. And so if you have Hashimoto's, there are plenty of studies where the researchers actually suggest that Hashimoto patients should be checked for celiac disease, because there's such a close relationship between the two. And that if you have celiac disease, you are like, I think it's something like 3 to 4 times more likely to also then develop Hashimoto's on top of it. So you want to know if you have celiac disease. I'm not saying this is like, you know, towing the party line of those who are just pro-celiac and whatnot, because we have plenty of organizations here in the United States that just talk about celiac disease and gluten sensitivity as like the ugly stepsister. But it is important to know that for your own health and to be a better advocate for yourself. And yes, I do think that a lot of people can benefit from having a greater awareness of what they are eating, and realizing that just because your mom or your brother or your best friend can eat something doesn't necessarily mean that you should be able to eat it. We're all different. Our bodies are unique. We have a unique history, unique genetics. You can't assume that you're just going to be the same as everybody else. It's not how it works. And when you open up to that idea, it's amazing what can happen with your health when you start to really pay attention and become a detective of that, of those culprits.
Absolutely. Now, I interviewed Dr. Tom O'Brien, who I don't know if you've ever heard of his work before. Do you know Dr. Tom?
I do actually know Dr. Tom personally.
Well, there you go. What a lovely man he is. But he said when I interviewed him, I think it was around this time last year, that whenever anyone eats gluten, there's going to be inflammation in the body somewhere, usually in the digestive tract. It's just one of those rules, like you can't go for a whole day without drinking water. Like, you just can't get away with that. Now, you're a health coach. Have you ever seen anyone stop eating gluten and not feel better? Because I'm still yet to experience that.
Actually, I have. So my husband, for example, we've been together for 10 years now. We've been married for 5. And he twice has done gluten-free, very strict gluten-free. And he actually did it again this summer because he has a very long history of struggling with migraines. And one was so bad that we almost ended up in the emergency room this past summer. So his decision was, instead of going on medication that was recommended to him by a neurologist, that he would give gluten-free a try again, like full hardcore gluten-free for 6 to 8 weeks. And he did do it. And just so everybody's going, oh, well, you know, like people fall off the wagon. My husband knows how to do this because of me. We eat mostly at home, but he also knows how to dine out and eat and ask the right questions. He's been doing this with me a very long time. And so he said he had a little more energy, but aside from that, he didn't really notice any difference, and he still got headaches and whatnot. So that's the thing. I think that I am very a little cautious, and obviously Dr. Tom, you know, has a lot more access to different medical things than I do. I just think we have to be cautious with too general of blanket statements, because we're all different. So I do think that gluten can be a major problem for people, and I do think there's probably a heck of a lot of people out there who don't realize that gluten is a problem, and they're being told through the media, especially in the United States, that, oh, gluten sensitivity is a joke. But that's why I would just say it may not just be gluten. There's a lot of food proteins out there now that people are becoming increasingly sensitive to. And so for me, I'm not just sensitive to gluten. I'm also sensitive to dairy and the casein protein, which is in all dairy. I'm also sensitive, highly sensitive to eggs, so I cannot eat eggs at all. I'm sensitive to the cruciferous family, those lovely leafy greens like kale, cauliflower, cabbage, and such. So I think that we each, again, it's better if we always hold in our minds that idea of being a little skeptical and testing it out for ourselves and seeing if it works, rather than assuming that what works for one person is going to work for us, because that can sometimes lead people down a path that's not correct. And I would never want to see somebody waste a year or two doing a protocol that isn't appropriate for them. But I would also say too, if you believe that gluten's an issue, like I said, if you want to take it out hardcore, like full 100% for 2 weeks and you feel better, at that point, I would say go get checked for celiac disease. And I know that Dr. Tom would agree with me on that, because autoimmune issues are very serious. It's not something you just want to be like, oh, it doesn't matter. You want to know, because guess what? I started this journey back in 2008. It's seven, almost 8 years now. I'm not going back to eat gluten in order to figure out whether I have celiac disease, because I had to have to eat gluten for 6 weeks in order to have all the testing done, aside from genetic testing that can be run. Except even if you have those genes or you don't have those genes, it doesn't matter. You could have the genes and still not have celiac disease that manifests, or you could not have the genes and actually end up with celiac disease. So there really is no guarantee with just doing the genetic testing that you're going to have celiac disease. So I'm not consuming gluten for 6 weeks in order now at this point, knowing what it does to me, in order to find out. And it's something I can't say I regret it, because it wasn't my fault. I didn't know. My practitioner never told me this information, but it is something that I tell people repeatedly because it's one of the things I wish I knew.
Absolutely. So let's talk about gluten's effects on the body. What actually happens inside us when we eat something like gluten?
Well, it depends. If you have celiac disease, gluten will trigger an immune response. And so the antibodies will confuse gluten with your tissue, essentially in the small intestine, and it will attack the microvilli and cause devastation in the small intestine that can result in nutrient deficiencies, terrible digestion, and a whole host of other problems. Because, I mean, I can't even go into how many issues can result, but any number of nutrient deficiencies that result by the devastation of the small intestine can cause a myriad of problems, of health problems that don't seem to fit together and don't make any sense. But some of the symptoms of celiac, some people will have digestive problems, some people won't. If you do, that's probably a more classic presentation of either constipation or diarrhea, gas, bloating. You may put on weight, some people lose weight. But then you can also have issues with neurological symptoms. You can feel like you're drunk. You can have brain fog, anxiety, depression. You can end up with issues with your teeth, and canker sores are actually a symptom of celiac disease. And sometimes people will have yellowing or discoloration of their teeth with celiac as well. You can have joint pain, fatigue, as we talked about, low immunity. Any number of things. I mean, it's just rashes. There's definitely certain rashes that are more connected to celiac than others. And as far as gluten sensitivity is concerned, you can have all the same symptoms. You can even have more severe symptoms than someone with celiac disease, but not be presenting with that damage to the intestinal tract, nor antibodies to particular tissue in the body that would be indicative of an autoimmune disease. So if you are presenting with a food sensitivity, they would be looking at IgG antibodies in your system. So what happens essentially is you consume gluten, you have a gut that's leaky. And if you want to think of your gut as, and I'm sure probably Dr. Tom described this in some way, shape, or form, but you end up with what's called gut permeability, or as we may call it on the internet, leaky gut syndrome, where there's essentially larger spaces between the cells that line the digestive tract. The enterocytes have space between them where there should not be any space. And there's only actually one layer of cells there. And so undigested proteins sneak into the body And your immune system thinks, oh my gosh, there's an intruder, and it mounts an attack. It really does mean well. It wants to protect you. It just doesn't realize that what it's attacking is a food particle. And so that is essentially how you start this whole process of any type of food sensitivity, to be entirely honest with you. And it's quite common for people who have leaky gut syndrome to start developing more sensitivities. So if you find that you're all like, you know, oh, well, I figured out that I was gluten sensitive, and then all of a sudden now I seem to not be able to tolerate dairy. And then 3 months later, oh, I can't seem to have like cucumbers or tomatoes or any like apples, any number of like random things start popping up that seem to bother you. That's a pretty surefire sign that you probably have leaky gut syndrome and that a lot of food proteins are sneaking into the body and causing issues. Now, if you do address leaky gut, typically the ones that are not usually gluten will resolve themselves. Sometimes you can, things that shouldn't really be a problem, like lettuce or peppers or what have you, those kind of healthy things, typically you'll see those resolve. With gluten, and I've just noticed for myself, like dairy and eggs, those never resolved at all. Those three things are something I'm still dealing with and will probably deal with for the rest of my life. I've accepted that, and I have created my life so that I don't feel like I'm missing out. But that's an important point that people need to realize is that you don't have to be stuck in a state where you're increasing the amount of sensitivities that you have to food. If that is the case, then you want to find a practitioner that can evaluate you for leaky gut syndrome or gut permeability and get treatment with them rather than trying to handle it on your own, because at the end of the day, you don't really have a gauge by which to monitor what's going on, what's working, what's not. And I'm also very cautious. My sister is an herbalist and an acupuncturist in California. And yes, there are many herbs out there that you can take to aid in the healing of leaky gut syndrome. The problem is, which she cautioned me, is that we have to have the same amount of reverence and respect for herbs, for food, for things that have tremendous power to heal or to make us sick. We have to have that same respect that we would have for pharmaceutical drugs as we do these other things that we believe shouldn't hurt us, like an herb, like say sage or marshmallow root or dandelion root or any number of things. And so just be cautious before you start going down this path and going, oh, I'm going to take all these different supplements I read about online, because they can trigger other issues. And it is good, especially with herbs, if you're going to go down that route, make sure that you do work with someone who's knowledgeable. And you also want to be careful. I know that there's a big trend toward using essential oils, which I'm not the biggest fan of for a number of reasons, but be really cautious before you start dousing yourself with essential oils and drinking them down. In the United States, it's a big business, a very big network marketing business, and those companies are really fueled to help their resellers sell those goods. So just be cautious and approach your health from a state of reverence, especially once you've gotten to a place where you don't feel well. Sometimes it's good to have a helping hand pull you back out, so that way you get to where you want to go faster and without causing other damage in the process.
I'm so glad you said that about having reverence for food and kind of the naturopathy way of healing things with natural stuff. And I agree with you about the essential oils. I'm still not sold on that whole idea myself. It's one of those things that I think is more about money than necessarily, hey, here's what's definitely going to help you. But let's go now to kind of the quitting gluten side of things. So why are cravings for gluten so intense? And why is the thought of not eating it so terrifying? Because I imagine you, as an Italian, pretty much would have eaten gluten all the time. How yes. What was your mindset going into saying, all right, I'm just not going to eat this anymore? Like, how challenging was that?
Well, the first thing that I realized was that if I approached my diet from a whole foods perspective, you can narrow down gluten pretty quickly because it's really only found in certain grains, namely barley, rye, oats that are contaminated, wheat, spelt, and a few others, which in the United States are not frequently sold, but maybe even, well, we do see like einkorn wheat, farro, which is an Italian grain, and some other ones, but the few that I mentioned initially are the big problems. And a great acronym for somebody who's new to this is BROWS, B-R-O-W-S. That way you can just easily explain it to people. I don't like the whole, like, I'm getting up on my soapbox and I'm going to lecture you because I think you should do what I did. I find that that actually turns most people off when you try to do that to somebody. So I'll just say, if somebody asks me where gluten is, I'll just say, oh, well, there's a great acronym. It's BROWS. Stands for barley, rye, oats that are contaminated, wheat, and spelt. Oh, okay. Great. And it'll actually invite a better conversation than lecturing a person right off the bat. So what I did was, as I was looking at my diet and saying, okay, well, what are the recipes that I like to make? I mean, obviously I could substitute pasta for gluten-free pasta. The bread at the time was terrible. And I'm not actually a big fan of gluten-free bread at all. If you go to glutenfreeschool.com, I have several very frank and honest discussions about gluten-free bread and why I don't think that it should be a staple of one's diet and some of the very terrible ingredients that it's loaded with in order to provide that that sensation that you're eating bread, but in reality it's just a bunch of very, very refined carbohydrates and oils and things that are really not good for you at the end of the day. But I got Italian cookbooks here, and they're not gluten-free, believe it or not. They're not gluten-free, but these are cooks that, or chefs that are Italian from Italy. Like, they cook in the Italian style, and so much of their recipes are naturally gluten-free. And believe it or not, in Italy, Italy is one of the easiest countries to go to for vacation and eat gluten-free with almost no problem because they are very well versed on how to do it. So it has just been amazing to me, like, when I stopped feeling like I needed this crutch of gluten, like with bread, with pasta and all this stuff, I started to open up my horizon saying, okay, well, what can I eat? Well, it turns out there's tons of things that I can eat. Most of what's in the produce section with the vegetables and the fruit, that entire section of a grocery store is pretty much all gluten-free, assuming that it's not in a package. And if it is in a package, like, sometimes in the United States, we'll have like nuts and legumes or beans or grains sold in packages there. Like, those types of things, I would say absolutely you want to make sure that they are marked gluten-free because there is a chance for cross-contamination in the process of getting those things into those bags. Sometimes different products will be run on the same lines, and thus if the line wasn't cleaned properly or well enough, you could have contaminated staples. But if you're looking at like vegetables or fruit, you shouldn't have an issue at all. And so that was the thing, like looking at that, realizing that I could have, you know, different meats, different fishes, different types of dairy if I wanted to, which I don't consume. If for others, people out there, if they can do eggs, you can do eggs. I mean, you want to think about the food that comes from nature, focus on that. And if worst comes to worst and you're really stuck, go on Google, pick your favorite recipe, type in the word paleo afterwards and hit enter. And I guarantee you will be able to find at least 10 or more recipes that will be naturally gluten-free. They'll be much healthier for you and will make your life a ton easier.
And generally, you don't need to feel too bad about eating that kind of stuff. Like, thank God for paleo desserts and all that kind of stuff, because they're actually really not too horrendous. I mean, obviously, you shouldn't eat them 3 times a day, but you can generally get away with that kind of stuff. Now, I kind of want to go back to the cravings thing, because when I tell people, hey, I think you need to stop eating gluten for a while and see what happens, usually that makes people very upset. Why exactly is it so scary to think about quitting gluten?
Well, the reason, I think it's important that I address the reason why it's so scary to give up gluten in the first place. There's a number of reasons, and I think you don't realize it until you actually have to stop eating the way that you're used to eating. So number one, you think that gluten is all you eat, and that it's all you like, and you also are of the mindset that gluten is in everything, which, as I have just said, is not true. Now, the other issue is that the food that we eat, generally speaking, plays into the relationships that we have. It plays into our social life. It plays into our family heritage. Think about the holidays. Maybe you have favorite meals that you're used to having for Christmas or New Year's or whatever holiday you celebrate that's special to your family. You have specific things that you expect. Well, now all of a sudden you may not be able to eat those. And you're the one person sitting at that table of 5, 10, 15 people that all of a sudden is throwing a wrench into the wheel. The wheel that ran perfectly fine beforehand, and all of a sudden now everyone's got to accommodate you. So most people don't want to, number one, give up their favorites. And number two, they also don't want to feel like the odd person out, causing all sorts of problems. And believe it or not, a lot of people will get upset, and it's natural. I don't get offended or hurt if somebody gets really upset that I can't eat gluten anymore. I used to. But I realized that it's not really about them. They don't understand that my taking care of myself is about me. And I'm okay if they're not willing to accommodate me. I'm okay with that at this point. But I also want to understand what's going on for them, that it challenges them or provokes such an emotional response, so that we can move beyond that and they can understand that I'm not judging their diet. Because a lot of times when someone says, I can't eat something, the other person doesn't hear the rest of what's going on. They don't even hear that it makes you sick. They might not believe that it makes you sick, but what they do perceive is that you are judging the way that they eat, and they feel that they eat just fine. And so it's from there, that miscommunication that can cause a real problem.
That's such an interesting point to make, because I bet if you went around to someone's house and said, hey, look, I'm intolerant or I can't eat nuts, they'd be like, oh. Okay, well, we'll change what we were going to make. They would totally not have a problem with it. That's such an interesting perspective that you just brought to the table there.
Yeah, and I think, I work with a lot of women, especially who are struggling with, number one, they're the only person in their household that has to go gluten-free. I've had clients whose husbands are blatantly disrespectful to them, and it breaks my heart that taking gluten out of your diet could trigger so many problems. And in reality, I would argue that probably those issues existed beforehand. This just really brought them front and center. There are issues with like children. The kids will like intentionally bring things into the house that they were asked not to. Family members will intentionally add gluten to dishes and not tell the person and go, oh, well, a little bit won't hurt them. And then after the fact be like, oh, well, yeah, that cheesecake was gluten-free except for the crust. So I've heard all the variations of the disrespectful relationship interactions that go on between family members and friends for the number of years that I've worked with clients. But I think at the end of the day, you have to make the decision for yourself. If this really makes you sick, who are you making a priority? Is it everyone else or is it you? Because at the end of the day, nobody's making you a priority. They want you to do what they want to do because it's easier for them. So no one's going to stand up for you. And this is beyond gluten. This is just about how do we prioritize our health? How do we prioritize even beyond our health? How do we prioritize ourselves in our lives to make sure that we are not just operating so that we can accommodate everyone else? And the thing that going gluten-free and taking all these foods out of my diet has really taught me at the end of the day is I have to, number one, want to do this first and foremost. Number two, I have to be consistent. So I can't ask everybody around me to respect my wishes to be gluten-free and then cheat when I go to parties. Because guess what? Why does your family have to try and help you out if you can't even abide by your own diet? I mean, at the end of the day, it's a reasonable argument to be made. So consistency is important. If you do need help in going to events, like first of all, I'll tell you, you got to plan. Like don't just show up to events and not tell anyone you're gluten-free or not call and find out if you can even eat there in the first place. But number two, if you really need support, ask your partner, your spouse, your best friend that's going with you. Say, listen, if I'm tempted, I really need you to say no. Like, I really need support to help me get over the hump and get used to feeling comfortable doing this. But don't tell everybody that, because everybody's not going to help you. One or two people are going to help you. And then number three, you have to accept that this is the way it's going to be. Because I think, and I don't know if in Australia you have this, but there are a lot of these like gluten pills out there now. And although I have repeatedly asked for studies, and I actually have a couple studies that I need to review from two different companies, most companies don't have any human clinical trials demonstrating that those pills work. And so what happens is...
What is a gluten pill?
So a gluten pill is a supplement that you can take. And again, I don't know if you have them in Australia. It's like big, big, big thing here in the US now. You can take this pill before you eat, and it supposedly will break down the gluten, the structure of gluten. So it's an enzyme that will chop apart the structure so that you can then digest gluten, essentially. Now, most of them will tell you that it's not to be used so that you could go and have a gluten-filled pizza. You shouldn't do that. It's only for small amounts, so you would do it to avoid cross-contamination. But there are some companies that have contacted me, and I only know this because they contacted me for advertising. I have a fairly popular big website in the United States. And they'll, and of course I say, well, I need to see research. Oh, no, no, that's proprietary. But I can promise you that anyone can use these and even eat gluten and be fine. I have saved the emails because I want to eventually go back to all these companies and again request studies. Like, I want to see them because I actually believe that it could even potentially violate some of the FDA claims, the claims issue that some of these companies are making. And so what I don't like is that companies are selling these pills saying that they work, but there's a myriad of factors to consider when someone uses an enzymatic pill. Is that in order for enzymes to work, they work between a specific pH range. Not they work in all instances. I mean, that may be possible, I don't know, but typically there's a pH range. So the acidity or alkalinity of your, essentially your stomach, where they would start to be activated. What happens if you have low stomach acid and those enzymes need to be activated by stomach acid? Do you think they're going to work? I don't think so.
I would highly doubt it.
And I actually talked to a biochemist, the head biochemist for, I believe it was Jaro Supplements, and he told me the exact same thing. He said, you know, it's really hard for us to guarantee that any of these pills, because they do have a supplement out on the market now, it's very difficult for us to guarantee that they will work under all circumstances because of the stomach acid issue. And so for me, the concern is that I feel some of these companies are selling a hope that they can't guarantee, that they can't really back up. And I know plenty of people who have written me, I get emails every day from readers who have said, yeah, I was taking these pills, they worked fine. And then all of a sudden, this one time I got really sick. Well, either they hadn't consumed anything with gluten, which is always a possibility until that point, and the pills didn't work or they don't work, or they were consuming something that had gluten in it, but their stomach acid was low and maybe the enzymes weren't activated. I mean, there's so many number of possibilities that could be in play there. And so for me, I feel like, you know, you just have to accept, like, this is the way it's going to be. And it's okay. There is life after gluten. There's a good life after gluten. And in fact, I would argue that your health is more important than consuming some sort of gluten-filled food. Because at the end of the day, my life is so much better than it was years ago before I went gluten-free. Because now I have the health that I wish I had when I was in my later 20s and I was sick as a dog.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you say that they promise you that their pills will work. I would have thought conclusive research would be a pretty good promise and guarantee that things would work. But
yeah,
I don't know. I'm not a big gluten pill manufacturer. That's a funny
yeah,
one.
And to answer your second question about cravings can be intense for gluten. I mean, there are certain proteins that can be released from or certain chemicals, I should say, biochemicals that can be released from gluten and even casein, which is the protein found in all milk. There's gluteomorphine and caseomorphine. And both of those can affect the brain. And that could be one reason why you feel like you're addicted to gluten. I think, and this goes back to, I just want to say this quickly because I know that we've been talking for a while about this, but part of the reason is what you're used to. There's habits that you've created that you're used to having certain things in certain times of the day. It's like cigarette smoking. I've never smoked, but you know, from my understanding that there are habits built into someone's day that trigger them to want a cigarette. And there, it's the same thing with food. You know, maybe you had a sandwich every day for lunch. You're conditioned to have a sandwich every day for lunch. And on top of it, some people may actually crave, and it's interesting, it's the same with diabetics. And this is something that my father had shared with me, and he's a medical doctor and a surgeon. He said, you know, it's interesting how the body will crave things that will make it sick. And so, you know, why that is, they don't entirely know. And I don't have any research to back up why that is. This was something, you know, that, I think we're all still in the process of trying to figure out. And that's an important point, is that we are still trying to figure all of this out. There is no definitive answers to some of these questions, because even the testing for celiac disease, is still not, there's not really a golden standard. A gold standard, even though a lot of people say X, Y, and Z is the gold standard for celiac testing. I talked with Dr. Alessio Fasano. He was on my podcast a year ago, and I asked him, you know, is there a gold standard? He said, no. He's like, we're still trying to figure out how the best way to diagnose celiac disease. And I actually, in doing some research for my grad school homework, I came across an interesting study from researchers and physicians in Italy who have figured out a potential saliva test to test for celiac disease. So, you know, we are still at the beginning of all of this. I'm not saying that we don't have any answers, but I try to approach everything from the space of a skeptic, you know, and ask, like, what is the person's agenda? You know, like, why do they need me to believe this? And let me do a little bit of my own homework and figure it out, because that's how we have a conversation. That's how we see progress in this world, not just like buying into everybody's ideas. And that's something, you know, that I found true again and again with clients. I recently had a client who swore that she thought it was gluten, and she was eating like a super clean paleo diet, and she was still super sick. In fact, she was getting sicker and sicker and putting on weight and couldn't lose it. And it turns out she has a histamine intolerance. And so she was sensitive to so many random foods. We couldn't figure out what was going on as she was keeping a food journal, because it was like coconut and all these things. Now, coconut is actually okay on a high histamine diet, but she has an allergy to coconut. So she has all these food allergies on top of the fact that she has actual sensitivities to foods. And as we were going through and looking at all these different things, we came to realize that her diet is got to be really different from a lot of people, because just because like paleo bloggers and, you know, gluten-free people talk about how these whole foods are healthy, well, she can't eat mahi-mahi fish. It's a type of fish. It's a type of fish should be healthy, you know, especially if it's wild caught or what have you, best quality, but that has high histamine in it. So she can't eat it. So you can't... Yeah, so the point is that we're all unique. And at the end of the day, we shouldn't necessarily buy into somebody else's story because it sounds familiar. Do your homework. Do your research. Realize that you are your own best investigator. Give things a try, but always be skeptical. Because at the end of the day, I would never want to see someone. I mean, my client had been eating this way for years because she read online that these were the healthy foods that she should eat. And it turned out that almost everything she was eating was making her sick. And they were. They were all. She had a clean whole foods diet. And everything was making her sick because it was high histamine.
Wow. I don't know what I'd do without coconut. That'd be hard. That's a bad one. Now let's get to the money side of things, which is something that you cover really, really well in your book. In fact, in your book you say, eating cheap is going to ruin your health. But you also talk about gluten-free options to things. And some people listening to this might have noticed that the difference in price between... like a normal pizza base or like a hamburger bun or whatever versus a gluten-free version, price-wise, the gluten-free versions are worth a lot more, but they're not always more healthy. So if eating cheap is going to ruin our health, but more expensive gluten-free things aren't always good for us, what's going on there?
food companies know that people are looking for, number one, three different things to entice their palate and keep them coming back for more. And that is salt, sugar, and fat. And in reality, you might not, many of your, I don't know how the, how well-versed your listeners are in things, but, you know, when you eat carbs, even if it's pasta, like people who have diabetes are not supposed to really, you really shouldn't eat pasta. At least that's my opinion, because those carbs get broken down to glucose. Glucose is the smallest, common denominator, essentially. I mean, there are other types of carbs, simple sugar, so to speak, but typically carbs in a product are going to get broken down to glucose, and glucose is what then will spike your blood sugar. That's sugar. So we might not think of pasta itself as sugar, salt, or fat, but it's the sugar. And so gluten-free bread, some of it has, or even regular bread, you know, cheap bread has sugar in it. It has salt. They add different types of hydrogenated fats to it sometimes, or cheap oils to get us to come back for more. And of course you have wheat or the multi-grain versions that are all, I mean, they all get broken down into carbs, simple carbs, thus glucose, sugar. And so from there, they say, okay, well, we need to give people as much as we can get them to buy by lowering the price, making it incredibly cheap. So they swap out ingredients. They try not to lose product consistency and the taste that you love, but they want to help affect the bottom line of their business and make more profits. They want the profit margin on the product to be increasingly great, so that way they're making more money. Or so essentially it comes down to profit margins and such, because really they don't want, you know, if they're going to sell an item for $2, they don't want it to cost them $1.50 in order to get it on the shelves. That would not be a profitable place to be. At the end of the day, cheap foods are loaded with very cheap refined ingredients. And I had the pleasure of interviewing a woman, and she wrote a book, which I'm sure your readers, and I don't know if you've read this, it's called Pandora's Lunchbox.
I haven't heard of that one.
It's by Melanie Warner, and it is available on Amazon. She is a journalist, and she decided to go to one of these food conventions, but it's a food convention that's for food scientists. And what happens with food products is that scientists actually create the recipes, not a recipe developer. And they fine-tune using all these powders and that are beige and white and such to get the perfect food product that you can't tell isn't from real food. So she said one example she gave to me was that she went to a booth where they were showing you how you could actually mix these few ingredients together and make a yogurt that tasted like Greek yogurt, but didn't have any of the, it wasn't yogurt. And she's like, honestly, I couldn't tell the difference. But like blueberries and muffins are not really blueberries. They're this mixture of all these other little things, because blueberries in and of themselves don't have a long shelf life, right? Because shelf life is a factor here. They want the food to be able to sit for as long as humanly possible without going bad. And they want to also kind of instigate or really press the buttons of those taste receptors that are looking for the salt, fat, and sugar. And that whole salt, fat, and sugar comes from another book that I actually had to read as part of my grad school program called The End of Overeating by Dr. David Kessler. And again, that's available on Amazon as well. Really fascinating book. Looking at the food industry and what it does and how it intentionally manipulates food in order to get us to become obsessed with eating things that are terrible for us, that shouldn't even qualify as food, but they do. And so I think that what people don't realize is they think, okay, well, I'm going from a gluten-based diet to a gluten-free diet, so what I will do is I will buy gluten-free products to replace those. And I get it, like the beginning, if you kind of need that helping hand, all right, that's fine. But after a couple of months, you get on the wagon, you figure it out. That's the point where you need to begin to transition to adding more whole foods into your diet that are naturally gluten-free. Number one, you will increase the nutritional value. It will also help you in the process of healing. I use that term loosely because there are regulations around how to use the terms like cure and heal, at least in the US, but like improving your health, I guess we could say. It will expedite the process tremendously over eating refined gluten-free products. And it will also cost you a lot less. Because in reality, when you look at like how much gluten-free bread costs you, or crackers, or any number of things that are just like gluten-free products, they tend to be loaded with sugar, and they're also loaded with these a mixture typically of gluten-free grains. And one problem, which I don't know how big of a concern it is in Australia, but here in the United States, a big issue for us is GMO corn. And
massive here.
Yeah. And so like if you look at a lot of gluten-free products, corn is one of the main ingredients they use. And so, you know, if I buy anything at all with corn here in the US, I'm looking for something that says GMO-free corn. I mean, typically I will buy organic because at least in the United States, organic precludes GMOs. It cannot label GMOs as organic. But that's a big deal for me, and it's a concern. The other issue, too, is a lot of these flours that are being used in gluten-free products are so bad for your health. They are incredibly high glycemic, and I don't even care if it says brown rice flour. It is still high glycemic. Brown rice flour is not brown rice. White rice flour is not white rice. Quinoa flour is not quinoa. They're not the same thing. There was processing that went on in order to produce that flour that is much easier to digest than the grain itself. And so in order to get ourselves out of that, yes, like you could go and you could look up paleo versions for the bread and make it with like coconut flour or nut flours. There's definitely plenty of things out there that offer that ability. And now, at least in the U.S., we have a variety of new flours that are coming out, like cassava flour, sweet potato flour, like so many different, I think green banana flour. Like we have so many different flours that you could opt for that are not all these refined, incredibly refined starches. But that said, I think at the end of the day, it's just better to eat real food, like things that are simple, things you could cook up in 30 to maybe 45 minutes. Food, you know, like I did a cost comparison of like if you buy a can, I'll just give you this example because I don't know what it's like in Australia, so maybe you can speak to this, but like one can of organic beans, for example, is probably going to run you $2 to $2.50, like if you get them at a big store here called Whole Foods. If you go and buy a whole bag of dried beans and you cook them yourself, you could probably get the whole entire bag for maybe $2, maybe $3. So it's pretty even cost-wise, but you're going to get a heck of a lot more beans, organic beans, out of that bag and cooking them yourself than you will out of that can. So no, it is actually not expensive to buy real food. It just, you have to understand how to prioritize what you're going to buy and understand like what you're willing to give and budge on as far as like for me, like maybe in the beginning I'd shop by what we call the Dirty Dozen list. In the United States, some foods are heavily sprayed with pesticides. So I would avoid the foods that were the most heavily sprayed. But there are other things like avocados and sweet potatoes and onions I would buy conventionally grown because they were very low on a pesticide contaminated list. And so for me, I made those decisions. And then eventually I got to a point where I had, you know, I was like, oh, okay, I could buy grass-fed, pasture-raised beef, no big deal. And then like I started to pay attention to different discounts within the grocery store and realized that, you know, you can get like, you know, at least in the United States, when we get close to a sell-by date, so it's the date by which the grocery store has to get rid of or sell certain cuts of meat because, you know, they'll go bad, they will usually mark them down because they want people to buy them. And a lot of people are afraid to buy them because they think, oh my gosh, that meat must be bad. Well, it's not. There's nothing wrong with it. It just needs to be either frozen or consumed like in a day or so. And so like I'm able to buy you know, grass-fed pastured meats, chicken, turkey, beef, what have you, at a discount. And when it's available, I will buy a lot of it and throw it into my freezer. And so by doing that, I don't always have to buy like some of the meat products every week. I focus our diet tremendously around vegetables and real food. And, you know, at one point, you know, as I share in my book, which was the inspiration for the Savvy Gluten-Free Shopper, was that my husband was laid off suddenly from his job during the recession that we had. And we had to figure out how to make do on 1/3 of our annual income. And I was determined and I did make it work. And so everything in that book is like all the little kitchen hacks and things that I figured out about how to reduce food waste, which is a huge, huge reason why people spend so much money on food, is they waste about 40% of what comes into their house. You throw it in the trash.
You really hammered that food wastage point in your book.
Yeah.
You went through a lot of stuff on how to avoid, you know, buying stuff and then just chucking it out. That was great.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I didn't realize, like, now when I buy things and I have to throw them away, at like almost, I'm always like, when I hit my hand to be like, bad Jen, you know better. But I really, you know, one tip that I found out recently that I can share with you, is so cool, because have you ever bought celery and like you get it home, you know, to like make soup or something, and it like within a few days, it's like really limp and like you have to throw the whole thing of celery away.
Yeah, I've done that before, if I'm honest.
Okay. So what you do, I just found this out, it's so brilliant, is that you get aluminum foil or some sort of foil, and you put the celery, once you've taken off whatever you want to take off, put it inside the foil. Don't rinse it off, so there's no water in there or anything. Just put it in there and then roll it up and fold up the two ends. It will stay fine in your refrigerator for like 3 weeks.
Really?
Yes. And I actually still have it in here, and I bought it like over 3 weeks ago. I read it online and I was like, this is brilliant, because I hate throwing celery away. And so that was another like easy thing that I found to like make food go further. There are so many people in this world that are starving, and we throw away so much food. And the biggest chunk of food, aside from, you know, at least for folks that are trying to eat healthier, the biggest chunk of food is oftentimes food waste. It's the mindless food waste of not realizing, like not meal planning, not saying, okay, this is what I'm going to make this week, and I'm committed to eating it, instead of, you know, by come Wednesday or Thursday being lazy and then going out to eat instead of cooking. And then also too, just not being aware of how long things can stay in the refrigerator or how to store them properly so that they last. And then you end up
Your book is literally full of those kind of tips. I like the one about garlic. What was it you said? Minced garlic, put it in like a bowl or something like that, or a cup, and then cover it with olive oil, and it'll stay good for weeks. And whenever you need garlic, just scoop it out of olive oil.
Yeah, it's so great. And just make sure, I don't like plastic containers, because a lot of times plastic will take on the odors of whatever food is in there. And garlic is pretty pungent. So I prefer, I just personally, like, I'm not a fancy person. I'm very down to earth. And you know, that's how I was raised. And I, you know, my great aunts, who I have inspired me tremendously, they were first born in the United States here. I actually live in my great grandparents' house. My great grandparents came here from Italy. And so I don't believe in waste. And so I'll use like glass jars from stuff that I buy at the grocery store. I'll wash them out and just put them in my cabinet, and I'll reuse them for like storage. Or if I, you know, want to give people food, I'll put it in the jars and give it to them, as opposed to using plastic. But just use a glass jar. You want to pack, like, mince up the garlic, pack it down, like not squish it down, but push it down as much as possible, so you kind of get a flat top, and then pour in the olive oil, kind of tap it, let it all go down there so you can get the air bubbles out. Make sure it's always sealed. So if you go back in and you scoop a bunch out and you notice there's exposed garlic, you want to pour more olive oil back in there, and then just seal the lid and keep it in the refrigerator, and it'll keep just fine. So when I go and cook, I'm not even bothering mincing up garlic. It's already done. I just scoop it out and put it in the pan.
Absolutely. But yeah, your book is full of that kind of stuff. Now, two more quick questions for you, Jennifer.
Sure.
When it comes to planning what we're going to eat if we're going to go gluten-free, the world can suddenly look very empty, because people think, well, I would usually have toast for breakfast, my mid-morning snack might be a muffin, sandwich for lunch, pasta for dinner or something like that, or spaghetti or whatever it might be. And if you take that away from people, it's like, what do I eat? So for you, what have you eaten in the last 24 hours?
Sure. It's always funny when people ask me that because I'm like, do people really care what I ate? Like, I don't find that interesting, but I if it helps someone, then I'm more than happy to share. Let me think. Yesterday morning, it was not my most finest morning. Typically in the morning, I will make a protein smoothie, but not. I usually use like low glycemic berries or pumpkin puree in it because it's a low carbohydrate, and I'll do some sort of like either pea protein that's low. I try to do kind of like low carb, higher fat in the morning. I feel a lot better on that. But yesterday we have these Epic bars here in the United States. So it's like a meat based bar. I know that may sound gross to people who've never had it. I think it's dehydrated, but they're
like jerky in a food bar.
Kind of. Yeah. And so I figured like, you know, I don't like granolas and that kind of stuff and cereals. I don't usually ever eat that stuff unless I'm really traveling and in a pinch. But that's what I had for breakfast. And then I came back. Every lunch I have is a huge salad where I'll do – and I figured this out. This is another thing. This is another one of my – this is a healthy food tip. And actually, it does save you a lot of money. Instead of doing lunch meats anymore with my lunch, because I always like to have some sort of protein – so lunch meats are not good for you. I don't even care if they're organic. Like they're more or less a processed food. I get that. So fine, you want to have them on occasion, but not every day. So what I figured out is I could buy 1 pound of like that grass-fed beef and saute it up with some spices, and then I just keep it in the refrigerator. And I pull out, you know, I usually use it over the course of 4 days, and I'll heat it up in my microwave because I'm usually pretty pressed for time, and then just chop up some lettuce, cucumber. Artichoke hearts. I mean, I always have different vegetables and like sprouts and things. So it always is different. Little bit of olive oil, some maybe red wine vinegar or balsamic vinegar. And my toppings are always like sea salt, black or white pepper, garlic powder, and sometimes dried oregano. And I'll have that for lunch with a big, big glass of water. And then that'll usually carry me over to dinner. And last night we had chicken soup that I made homemade in our crock pot. I use organic chicken legs that still have the bone in – obviously have the bone in them because they don't usually take the bone out of chicken legs. But the bone as well as the skin. And I throw – the crock pot recipe is super easy. It's actually on my website for crock pot chicken soup. It's carrots, onion – celery, you put the chicken in and water, and you could add some spices if you want, you don't have to, and then cook it on low for 10 to 12 hours and you've got soup. And so I added some chopped up arugula, so like a green that you could add to a soup. I add like half of an avocado. I'll just like create chunks and throw that in there. And then some pico de gallo, so some like fresh salsa. I put that on top. And that was my dinner.
Did you say avocado in a soup?
Yeah.
Right. How does that go?
Oh my gosh, it's amazing. It's so good. Yeah, it doesn't get funny or anything. It'll stay green. I don't add it in if I'm going to store it. I put it in my bowl right before I'm going to eat it.
Fair enough. Now, the last thing I wanted to mention, I wrote this down. I don't know why I put it at the bottom of my page, but I did, is that gluten, if you're intolerant to it, is like a reverse nutrient. And it can cost money in ways that most people don't really consider. And that's if you eat something, it's supposed to go into your stomach and your intestine and whatnot. And we take all the nutrients out of it. Whereas if you go and eat gluten, it's like negative nutrients. So it stops the body's ability to get nutrients out of other food because there's so much inflammation and leaky gut going on, like you mentioned earlier. So what can be the cost of people or for people of being intolerant to gluten and eating gluten and needing to eat more food than they actually really should have to get the required amount of nutrients out of it?
Oh my, that could be tremendous. And one could argue if you have the autoimmune version, so celiac disease, that there's no amount of food that you would be able to eat that could potentially overcome the deficiencies that are created as a result. I mean, if you cannot, you know, it's one thing to be able to digest your food, and that for many of us is questionable, but if you cannot absorb it because your small intestine is decimated as a result of eating gluten, then that's an even bigger problem. I think when you have to think about the cost, and I know for a lot of people, I've given out plenty of dollar amounts in my book. You know, when I did the math, and I even there was a study that was done in Canada when it looked at the cost between gluten-free and gluten-filled foods. They were looking at like the comparison, cost comparison. They found that gluten-free food was 2.5 times more or less more expensive than gluten-filled food. So sure, we could go and do the math on all that stuff. But I would argue that it's the quality of life that you're missing out on. And I could tell you right now, oh, well, if you have celiac disease and you're eating gluten or you're cheating, you have an increased risk for cancer and all sorts of stuff. I guarantee you that won't stop people. What I want you to think about is the cost in your daily life of how you don't feel well. The things you wish that were running right, staring out the window and watching your children or your grandchildren play and being so fatigued and so exhausted that you cannot function. You can't care for your family. You can't get to work. When you think about the cost and you really honestly add it up, think about what happens to your marriage when you no longer have the energy or the passion to be a full partner in your marriage and you are sick all of the time. What is the cost of that? I don't even know that we can quantify that in dollars. We minimize the effect because we don't want to be honest with ourselves. The reality, the tremendous reality of what eating food that doesn't work for us will cost us. It costs you your happiness. It costs you your ability to be fully present. It costs you so many things that you can't get back. Because our life is precious. We have very little time here. I mean, look, the truth of the matter is, I might just have today. I don't say that to me grim, but the reality is we don't know. None of us know. And so we could dismiss the small things in life, but it's the small things that really count. And when you start to lose those and you lose your sense of feeling well, feeling in control, feeling like yourself, and you become a victim to all of, I mean, literally food. And it's wrecking. The consequences are massive because really the relationships that it wrecks, your job that you can't function at. I mean, I have plenty of people that contact me and said they lost their jobs as a result of not being able to get there and do their job. They couldn't think straight. They didn't feel well. They were so tired. I mean, they lost their job. So... really, I get it. Like, cancer's probably not enough to scare you because it's so far, maybe it's so far in the future and you don't know what that's like and you don't know how bad it would be. But how would it feel if you couldn't feed your family because you couldn't, didn't have the money to put food on the table? How would it feel if you couldn't make it to your kids' piano recital and everything that's important to be there for your children, you couldn't do it? How would you feel if you couldn't go on vacations anymore? Or that you can't even go out and eat anymore and enjoy your family. You can't even go to holiday meals. How does it feel when you are so sick and exhausted all the time that you can't get off the couch, you can't take care of your home, and your spouse doesn't understand anymore and is angry at you all the time? How does that feel? How much can you put up with? How much of that can you bear? Because eventually you will hit a breaking point or someone else will, and they will not tolerate it anymore. And you will lose that relationship. You will lose that job. If that is not a great enough cost for you to help you move forward and take action to improve the quality of your health, I honestly don't know what is. That's the best answer I can give you.
Well, I'll throw something else on top of that. Let's say 3 weeks no gluten, not a huge amount of time, and then reintroduce and eat some and just see how you feel. Or if you already feel better, go and get checked by a doctor, as you mentioned earlier. Worst case scenario, you've spent 3 weeks battling through trying not to eat something that you usually would eat, but now you know if you didn't get any negative symptoms or if you feel fine after 3 weeks when you go back on eating gluten, that it's not necessarily something that you need to stress out too much about. That's not a huge price to pay for peace of mind, I would have thought.
No, and absolutely. And then at least you've ruled that out. And then you move on to something else. Well, what's the next thing? Like, I would tell people to do a food diary. Before you take any food out, do a food diary for 7 days and track. Like, you don't have to write out like portions of like one cup of this and, you know, 5 ounces of that. But what did you eat? You had a salad with these ingredients in it. You had this meat, you had, you know, this to drink, you know, whether it's coffee or tea or what have you. Write that out. And if you get really sick, note it down. You know, like start to see patterns. So that way, if it's not gluten and you're like, okay, well, I'm not, so don't seem to be reacting to that. Go back to the food log and go, when am I getting sick? And honestly, the times when I had taken gluten out and I was still getting really, really super sick to my stomach, I couldn't figure it out because I wasn't tracking things like this. But in hindsight, when I look back, every time I got really violently sick was when I had eaten eggs. And I found out after having blood tests done that I have a very high sensitivity to eggs, much greater than to gluten. And the last time I ate eggs was almost, I guess, about 7 years ago. I still haven't had them since because I thought I was having a heart attack and I was about to rush myself to the hospital. I was in so much pain. So it's really important that you, you know, if you're going to be an investigator, you have to do due diligence and you need to track things and monitor things. And that way, at least if you do go to a doctor or a practitioner, you can show them that log. And that will help expedite the process rather than trying to piece it all back together from your memory, because most people are not going to remember things accurately. And from most studies they've found done on like recall food intakes, most people lie or underestimate how much they've eaten or what they've eaten. So you can't rely on your memory for that kind of stuff. It's best to write it down. So before you take anything out, track your diet for about 7 days, track any reactions. And it's not just physical. It could be maybe you became depressed. Maybe you became very angry, very emotional in some respect. Maybe you developed a pain someplace or your hands became red and swollen or a rash came out or you got itchy. Whatever it may be, it doesn't matter. Don't cast judgment over it. You're just observing as a scientist would, without emotion, without, you know, being like, oh, I'm onto something, it must be this. Don't assume, just watch. And then when you start taking things out, that's where the magic happens, when you can start to pay attention to that. And that's what I found to be really beneficial, at least for myself when I work with clients, that, you know, I'm never attached to any one outcome. Because I don't really know that we're ever going to get there. That's not fair to them. I have to approach that situation as if it is unique, because it is. And so that's the best piece of advice that I can give someone, that if you're going to take stuff out, do that first.
That's brilliant advice. I wish everyone would start keeping a food log, because it's such a valuable tool to have. And I think that's probably, I mean, I've kept you for over an hour, Jennifer. Sorry about that. But I think that's probably a good note for us to end on. Your book is The Savvy Gluten-Free Shopper, How to Eat Healthy Without Breaking the Bank, which is, I'm going to say something really weird. That was just a really nice book to read.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know why, but it was just nice to read. It just made me feel good.
Well, I tried to have a good attitude through it, because really I believe that any problem is solvable. You just have to be determined and open to finding a solution. And I wanted to share what I had learned, and I made it so that it was a reference book you could keep in your kitchen and you could go back to it, not some long drawn out stories of, you know, prose is wonderful, but it's not really helpful when you're just trying to figure out the practical nature of how do you feed yourself? How do you save money with food? So I wanted to make it as simple and easy as possible so that the tidbits were something you can remember and implement when you go to the grocery store the next time you're making dinner.
That was the other word that jumped out about your book, was practical for me. I did like the practicality of it.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you've that's come across, and I appreciate you sharing that.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, Jennifer. I really can't thank you enough for coming and sharing some gluten-free hacks for us. It's been absolutely delightful having you on the show.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. And I invite anyone who's curious, please come and visit me at glutenfreeschool.com. I definitely have plenty of articles and recipes and all sorts of things up there. And I, you know, if anyone wants to send me an email or something, you're more than welcome to do so. And I'd love to hear from you and hear if there's any feedback you have or any thoughts or questions, please feel free to get in touch.
Gotcha. Thanks so much, Jennifer. Have a nice day.
You too.
Authentic Wellness Radio.